Hello, this is Christopher Holmes. It is January the 23rd, 2010, and welcome to a two-hour session of Zero Point Radio Show through BBS Radio. Zero Point is also the name of the Institute for a Mystical and Spiritual Science. And next week I'm going to be relocating from Ottawa, Ontario to Cars, Ontario, and establishing the Institute there again, and hopefully be doing some public teaching, at least on a small way. My background and expertise is in mystical teachings and modern science, metaphysics, consciousness studies, ideas about psychology as a science of the soul. We discuss ideas about intelligent design, and we range widely over mystical and spiritual studies as well as science, and we also go into the political scene and what's happening in the world today. Often we break the show up, and as we will be today in the first half with my co-host, we'll be discussing mystical and spiritual teachings, and in the second half I have Canadian activist and member of the Alternative Canadian Action Party will be joining me online to talk about current events in the world and the problems in our society. Okay, so in the first half, I'll welcome my co-host, James Moffat. Jim, how are you? Welcome.
Thanks, Chris. I'm well, thank you.
You've been working hard. It was a nice note I got from you the other day where you went through, you've been working at writing your book, kind of a biography about myself and an overview of the work I've done through the last 30, 40 years on consciousness studies and such. And you sent me an outline of different influences we'd both gone through at different periods in our life. It was interesting to look back and have that historic perspective on things.
Yeah, it's, the book that I'm working on is called The Problem of God's Contracting Universe, which was the title of one of your earlier works in progress way back, I think, in 1979. I think you started first working on it. And although you don't really use that title anymore for any of your individual works, I would say that the whole corpus of your writings basically can be put under that heading. I think that's a very good label, and the phrase comes from was your answer to Carl Sagan's claim in his book Broke His Brain, which he wrote in the 1970s. He has a piece in there. It's a collection of different pieces that he wrote. One was called A Sunday Sermon, and in that he postulated that As science advances and provides increasingly comprehensive and detailed explanations of all phenomena in creation in terms of material explanations, there's really no longer any need to invoke a god or gods to explain things. And he claims that as science advances, there's less and less for God to do. And your reply to that was to say, is it true that, in fact, as material science progresses, there is indeed less and less for God to do? And you labeled that the problem of God's contracting universe. And I'd say that when you first were working on that, the first draft that you gave me, I can still remember it, you said that you planned to write 8 volumes in reply to Dr. Sagan's questions, drawing on the material sciences, the psychic sciences, and the esoteric and mystical spiritual tradition, to suggest that indeed God's days are not numbered, and that the advance of science really has nothing to do with doing away with God. And as I say, even though you don't use that title for any specific work, I think the whole last 30 years of your life has basically been an answer to that question, in a sense. Drawing on a wide range of mystical and esoteric teachings, you've articulated and developed a model of consciousness, which is consistent with much material in modern psychology and science, but I think it's much more comprehensive because it includes the spiritual elements and includes metaphysical explanations as well as physical explanations. And it starts, I think, with the limitations of materialism and goes beyond that. And so that you develop this very intriguing model of consciousness, and which is based on, which you've extrapolated from the mystical and esoteric traditions, especially the heart doctrine, which you articulate as an answer to what you call modern science and psychology's head doctrine, which claims that consciousness is produced in the head and is solely the result of the material processes in the head brain. And you articulate the heart doctrine, which runs throughout the mystical and esoteric tradition through a variety of teachings in both the East and the West. I mean, an astonishing number of teachings in which this appears. And then on top of that, you've developed the zero point teaching, which you developed mainly from the work of Madame Blavatsky and specifically from the secret doctrine. And it's very interesting. What I was doing the other day, I was reviewing the heart doctrine because I'm in the section on my book. I've already written like 7 or 8 chapters in the book, but I've been going back and revising it. And I had written 3 chapters about your work, like the beginnings of your work. And I was trying to think, well, how can I revise this and how can I really capture the essence of it? So I was going through your book, The Heart Doctrine, which I had read and marked up. And I didn't read the whole book, but I went through and I just read my notes and certain sections which I had highlighted. And it really struck me. As we've known one another since 1967 and have been involved in this study of mysticism and esotericism for almost 35 years together, it really struck me how at different points in your life, like you were interested in different influences and you got into these different topics that really captured your interest. For instance, the idea that consciousness and light are related. And you approached it from various angles. So you approached it from a scientific angle in terms of the holographic paradigm that's articulated by David Bohm and Carl Priebram. And then from a mystical and esoteric perspective and in a variety of wisdom teachings throughout the ages. And it really struck me how the different elements, it's not a linear process in a way. It's not that straightforward, but I can see how the different elements all kind of came together and you prepared yourself to understand these things as you went forward. Like, I don't think you could ever, I give the example in the beginning of my book, we often talk on this show about Paramahansa Yogananda's experience of cosmic consciousness, which he relates in his autobiography of a yogi, which is an astonishing explanation of what happens to him when his master reaches over and strikes him above the chest, and he begins to have an expansive instance of consciousness where he's seeing out of all his vision is all encompassing. He can see out of the back of his head, and he's interpenetrating various physical manifestations, like he can see the sap in rising in trees, and he goes into these deeper and deeper levels of samadhi, and eventually he is at one with the universe. And I remember we both read that book, I think about 1977 or 78 first, and I mean, we were both really struck by it, and we were struck by his explanation later when he talks about what master yogis can do, this, that they can make their mass infinite by identifying with the light of the universe, and so that they're uncontained by space and time in a sense. And I remember we were both really struck by that. But I think as over the years, as your model has become more sophisticated, I see now how we really had this very, you know, I think we saw the value of it, which is something in and of itself, and I think we grasped some of it, but I see how much deeper our understanding of that particular experience is. And that's the esoteric mystical tradition in a nutshell, and I think that we found it, the value of it, is that it continues to grow and evolve, and you get more detailed understanding of things, and at the same time you get more comprehensive understanding of things. So that's very unusual, I think, in most systems of thought that I've studied. I generally, as things get more comprehensive, you lose details, or if you get more detailed about things, you lose comprehension. Like your perspective becomes too circumscribed, and you don't have a comprehensive outlook. But what's different about the mystical and esoteric perspective, and that what you've really identified in your model of consciousness, is how all of these things can fit together, and the more you examine any one thing within it, the deeper you go into it, then the more detailed your explanation can be. So essentially, that's what I was responding to when I wrote you that note the other night, and I was just trying to think of, you know, it's 30 years, so 35 years, so there's some you know, gaps in my memory about it, but we've been working at this, and I just think it's really fascinating. I think the journey itself is in some ways as interesting as what you actually discover.
Yeah. Well, I'd like to go through some of those phases in a moment.
Okay.
But before we did that, I want to return just to the notion of the problem of God's contracting universe. And that, like you were saying, I think it was in the early 80s, I proposed to do a book series called that. And the idea was to investigate whether that was indeed true, whether science had invalidated the idea of God. And I thought that mystical and esoteric teachings provided a whole new angle on which to address that issue. And I see what I've always felt is that in a way the issue hinges on the question of the nature of human consciousness. Because in a way, when people say they believe in God, like partly what they mean by believing in God, it means you believe there's some intelligence beyond life and realms of existence beyond material creation, like heaven worlds or hell worlds or afterlife. So you believe in the existence of such things. And that implies that there's something in the human being that survives physical death. That we're not simply the material body, but there's some kind of soul or spirit or divine element in the human being. So I see the God hypothesis is related to what I call its corollary, which is the soul hypothesis. You know, does a human being have a soul? And it's like, well, scientists at times in the modern literature, they say about there are fewer and fewer gaps for God to inhabit in modern science, because the idea is that we used to explain things by saying God does it, whereas now science has explained things more and more all the way back to the beginning of the creation of the universe, and we don't find God anywhere. But at the same time, in a way, the whole of science is pervaded by enigmas. And the most important of those is the enigma of human consciousness. And mystical teaching says that originates somehow out of the physics of the heart. And the heart is connected to the soul life. And that there's some kind of spiritual element or spiritual self connected to the heart. But then it also, there's also, we can also look at the problem of God's contracting universe in other areas of science. And what I've found is, like, if we take, for instance, one of the findings of science, and scientists now trace the origin of our universe back to what they call a singularity point, infinitely small point, 10 to the minus 33 centimeters, and they say that emerged out of what they call the quantum vacuum, which is this realm of nothingness, or what appears to be nothingness, but which is really the quantum vacuum, and it's this huge kind of energy potential field that underlies creation. Okay, now those ideas that the universe emerged out of a realm, the void plenum of the vacuum, and the idea of the universe emerging from a point source, both of those are mystical ideas that have been around for centuries and even millennia, that the universe emerged from a point source. Okay, so when modern scientists in modern times, they trace the universe back to the beginning of time to a point source, and then they say, there God, we didn't find God anywhere. But at the same time, it was the mystics who have described that type of dynamic for hundreds or thousands of years. So in a way, even the data of science itself, I'm saying, confirm mystical notions. So see, Blavatsky in 1888 described our universe emerging from a point source. And she, in her book on cosmogenesis, on page one, it had a circle with a point in the center. And that point, she said, represented the first point of differentiation of a cosmos. Okay, and that was in 1888. Well, 100 years after Blavatsky, scientists arrived at the same idea of the point source origination of the universe. And then because they don't know mystical teachings, they think, oh, that proves that God has nothing to do with it. Whereas in fact, their theories support what mystical claims that predate them by centuries.
You have that quotation from Jonathan Cott where he's interviewing the rabbi, and the rabbi is talking about Kabbalists rabbis in the 14th century talking about the universe emerging from a point.
That's right. A beautiful quote in John.
Yeah, and
Jonathan Cott's book.
It's like as you say, these so many of these ideas that really have emerged from the really astonishing progress in 20th century physics. A lot of them, in Blavatsky's work, you cite in a number of instances where she talks about broken symmetries and about, everything emerging from nothing. I mean, it's the single point source is very consistent with what's been learned in modern physics. It's very interesting. I started reading this book before Christmas, and I put it down. I picked it up again, called Biology Revisioned by Elizabeth Satouris, who's a biologist, and Willis Harmon, who was with the, I believe he's passed away, he was with the Noetic Institute, I think, in California. And what Satouris is saying is essentially, as she discusses a variety of issues in biology and a lot of research which really contradicts the neo-Darwinian point of view, that shows, as she says, that the intelligence of everything, and she talks about holons within holons and the idea of the great chain of being, and everything that she's saying is essentially, again, consistent with the mystical perspective and with the esoteric perspective and the perspective that sort of the model of consciousness that she says that you have to account for consciousness and that's the problem with biology. I would say, the corollary to what you're saying, I agree with you, the most profound mystery is what is the nature of human consciousness, and the other mystery is what is the nature of life? What is life? I mean, in the one hand, you have modern materialist science saying that consciousness arises from non-intelligent matter somehow magically, and that life emerges from non-living matter somehow magically. And I mean, if you want to talk about miracles and invoking miracles to explain things, then those are the two greatest miracles of all time, really. I mean, in Sagan's work, he when he's talking about the problem of God's contracting its universe, he provides this rather contrived explanation, but he says, that it used to be thought that in order to explain the opening of the morning glory, that God had to micro-intervene. So God had to basically tell the morning glory, hey, flower, psst, open, And he said, but now we know that really, that the opening of the morning glory is a completely a phenomenon which is completely understandable and explicable in terms of natural processes. It's all due to plant hormones and to phototropism, and we don't need God. God doesn't have to tell the flower to open. Come on, it's idiotic. But it's funny, as I say, when you get to the question of how consciousness emerges from unintelligent material in the brain, or how life emerges from something which is described as non-living material, how does that happen? These are the two great mysteries, and I think they're they point to the utter inadequacy of the materialist explanation of things. It's a very good explanation within certain limits to explain and to describe things, not to explain them. That's one of the distinctions that Tourist makes about various things in biology, various theories, is that they describe things, but they don't explain them. And I think that's...
Yes, so often it's just labeling something.
Yeah.
And then you think if you've labeled it, like...
Would say, you know, people have this tendency to think that once they name something that they understand it, but, you know, there's knowing and there's understanding, and so we can know things in a certain way, like a perfect example is electricity. I mean, we can describe electricity, but nobody really knows what electricity is.
Yeah.
I mean, it's fundamental to our lives. We say, oh, well, you know, it's electricity. You flick the light switch on, and electricity makes the lights come on. Well, but what is it? Nobody really knows what it is.
Yeah. This is really, so what we have then, like, as fundamental enigmas, we have the enigma of human consciousness. And whether it's produced by material processes in the brain or if there's a higher spiritual physics in a way to the heart that self within the heart in mystical teachings is described as the source of not only consciousness in the living being, but also the life within the living being. Like it is the living entity within a human being. From a mystical perspective, in a sense, life comes from above, that there's this higher dimensional element or self that is embodied into the physical body. So life isn't produced from below, from matter, but rather it comes from above. So it also strikes me, looking at science, like how presumptuous it is when scientists think that they've kind of got all the answers. Because if even you look at Carl Sagan's Broca's Brain and his other writings, he still admits, he says, well, we still don't really understand the origin of the solar system or how the planets arose or how life arose or what life is and other, like all the basic questions in a way are still unanswered, although we've developed a lot more detailed understanding of the mechanisms of the principles of physics and the laws of biology and so on, we still can't explain what life is, and we still can't explain what consciousness is. And I would say that another area of enigma is the massive body of cases supportive of various kinds of psychical and mystical experiences, ranging from people's sensations and experiences of being out of the body, near-death experiences, remarkable coincidences which show the interrelatedness of events in different medium, ghosts, poltergeists, past life memories, all these kinds of psychical phenomena, and many of which have been researched by hundreds and thousands of scientists through history and investigators. So there is a massive body of literature documenting the basic notion that there's something more than meets the eye. There's something more to life than simply material reality, that we are something other and that life extends beyond the material body. So that's a whole other area of enigmas, and the mainstream scientists just say there's no evidence for the paranormal, and they just live simplistically because it's inconsistent with their perspectives. But really, there's massive evidence that we need to consider a multidimensional universe where human beings live on all different planes of existence and that we pass between these. So that's a third area of enigmas. And a last point I want to make, an example, it's interesting, Carl Sagan's example of how we don't need God anymore because now we can explain the opening of the morning glory seed. We can explain it in terms of the sun's radiation and the process of phototropism and and such. So then we don't need God. But if you actually look at what Blavatsky says in the Secret Doctrine, for Blavatsky and throughout the mystical traditions, the sun is regarded in a way as God's representative for us. Like the sun is our local God. In a way, the sun is the source of light and life within the solar system. Just like the Jiva Atma within the heart is said to be the light and life principle in the inner cosmos. Well, in the outer cosmos, the sun is the source of light and life on planet Earth. And all of organic life on Earth, as it evolved, it was under the influence of the sun. So, in fact, and throughout all the different religions, and this is a basic teaching in Egyptian religion, in India you have what's called Surya Yoga, the yoga of the sun. It is believed that we're all sons of the sun. It is said that the inner man, in a way, comes from the sun, and that the sun is connected to our higher spiritual self, spiritual nature. So, and it is further said that the sun itself is a living being. And actually, it is said that there are seven spiritual intelligences or archangels associated with the sun. So, the sun isn't simply a mass of dead, inert matter in combustion. Instead, the sun itself is a living being, an embodiment of these spiritual intelligences. And the rays of these seven beings are said to permeate the ether of our solar system. So the sun, it's not only the physical rays of the sun, but it also is the center of the psychical and spiritual realms. So the sun, you know, so for Carl Sagan to say, oh, we don't need God anymore now because we got the sun. Well, I mean, that doesn't disprove mysticism. Mysticism says the sun is God's representative, like it's the source of light and life on the planet Earth. That's how God effects his creation, is through the sun. So it's stupid to say, well, because we know about the sun, that doesn't answer it at all. See, Blavatsky says the sun has a zero-point center, and it is rooted into the invisible sun, and that there are these seven spiritual intelligences, the seven rays, the seven logi, and it is the intelligence of these beings which fashions the solar system by design. So even examples like that, Jim, when you look at them, really, like Sagan's example of how, you know, we don't need God, now we can explain phototropism and plant hormones, you know, in a way it makes no sense at all. It doesn't really address the underlying issues.
Well, see, he thinks he knows what the sun is. He thinks he knows that the sun is just a big bag of gas that, as you say, is combusting and sending radiation to the Earth, and that all there is a material process. But that's sort of the conceit of modern science, is that everything is reducible to a material process, to the mechanisms in which material processes underlie the dynamics of things, and everything is reducible to that. But when you really begin to look at it, and it's interesting, in this biology revision book I'm reading, they cite the work of Lovelock, James Lovelock, and Lynn Margulis on the Gaia hypothesis about the idea that you can conceive of the planet as a living being. Although, even though they put forward that idea and said, you know, this is a better way to think about it, Lovelock especially has sort of backed off that because of the anthropomorphizing. He thinks it's inherent in that, but it's interestingly that, as Satouris explains, you know, that this is actually it's illogical to back off that if it is a living being, you know, you have to describe things. It's not it's not just a metaphor. What you're describing is the dynamic and animate nature of the cosmos, and that's what she argues. Ironically, by the way, Lynn Margulis used to be married to Carl Sagan, and her work on her biological work really shows that at the level of the cell, there are all sorts of intelligence and evidence of intelligence that defies mechanical explanations. That's the problem with all of this is that really there's amongst materialists in modern science, they think that everything can be explained in terms of material processes and mechanisms, but really there aren't any mechanisms in nature. That idea comes from Descartes, but Descartes said that God was the inventor who was behind all these mechanisms. God put these mechanisms in place. But once you take God out of the equation, then you have mechanisms. But there's no such thing as a mechanism in nature. Like, nothing spontaneously assembles itself as a mechanism. That's absurd. And in the example, too, that you were giving, I remember many, many years ago, one point we were talking about this, and you said something like something about, oh, the sun isn't an intelligent being, and I started to laugh because I immediately thought of, you know, well, we associate the idea of the sun being an intelligent being with primitive people and past ancient peoples, you know, who weren't sophisticated in the ways of science. And then you added, all it does is maintain all life on planet Earth. You know, like when you think of it in those terms, you know, it's like, is there anybody out there who can do that? Like, can we talk about intelligent beings? I mean, you know, it's only because we have this supposition that all that the sun is a big bag of gas, basically, you know, or a big body of gas. I mean, if you go beyond the material, and that's the challenge in science, it's like, then it's quite reasonable to assume that if the cosmos is animate and is intelligent and is alive, then everything in your understanding of things has to change dramatically. And also, the other thing is that if you go beyond just a strictly material explanation and start to recognize the idea that there are higher dimensions of materiality beyond that which is physically observable, that changes everything. And I mean, that's the essence of the mystical esoteric tradition, is that there are these higher levels and dimensions of consciousness and materiality and being, which are informing lower levels, and that what we see and what we observe in the material realm is not the complete picture, that there are dimensions beyond that, and that these dimensions are higher and that they inform the lower dimensions. And once you have that understanding, everything changes. Everything completely changes. And again, like when you begin to explore that, it's entirely consistent and addresses a lot of the enigmas that modern science has actually confronted in its study, especially in physics. But also, as Satouris points out, If the cosmos and is multidimensional, and if it's animate and it has life and it has consciousness at higher levels, then that does away with the enigma of how do we explain the emergence of life and consciousness. She says, I don't think life and consciousness emerges from lower levels from material processes. I think it pre-exists on some other levels, and that, you know, that addresses that enigma.
Yeah, there are really so many mysteries. Like, there are so many things, like, we don't understand the origin of the formation of the solar system. It's, as another example, I've just finished rereading Blavatsky's The Secret Doctrine, and it's amazing how, in 1888, she was arguing that gravity as a force does not exist. And she was saying, we have the wrong understanding of gravity. And she was explaining that really gravity is a variation of the fundamental, what she calls Fohat, or cosmic electricity. And that there are seven variations of this cosmic electricity. And that gravity is really a variant on electromagnetic force. And this is the idea they're coming to in modern physics, because they're unifying the laws of physics all into one coherent theory. And so all the forces of nature, Blavatsky was saying, are variations of electromagnetism. And she says that it's really the sun, it's that gravity in a way is the law of attraction. So the sun holds the as an electromagnet, has an influence through the different levels of the ether, and that attracts and holds the earth. So the sun somehow, the dynamism of the sun attracts and holds the planet. So there's that. And it's not simply due to gravity. It's an electromagnetic phenomena propagated through the ethers. And she says there's a sevenfold ether of space. So it's an alternative model of the nature of gravity. And now, it's very interesting. You see other enigmas in science, like scientists look out at the structure, say, of a galaxy in space. And the scientists, because when they judge the mass of the galaxy and the rotation of the galaxies should be all flying apart, but they're not. That's why scientists had to postulate the existence of dark matter, which holds that galaxy together. Because otherwise it should be flying apart. So they think, oh, there's got to be dark matter. And they think 95% of matter now they think is dark matter. Okay, well, see, this is trying to prop up. See, if you got the wrong understanding, you think the galaxy is held together by gravity, which Blavatsky denies. See, Blavatsky says the galaxy has a dynamic zero-point center at the center of the gravity and and that zero-point center, it propagates its influences through the ether on different levels of the ether, and it binds together that galaxy. So it's not held together by gravity, and you don't have to find dark matter because it's not gravity holding the galaxy together. See, so this is another example of science where there's this enigma trying to find the dark matter. But if you eliminate gravity, the old understanding of it, and have an electromagnetic understanding of it in terms of the law of attraction and the knowledge of the ethers of space, then it gives another explanation. You know, there isn't missing dark matter because it's not gravity that holds the galaxy together. It's the fact that the galaxy itself and the individual suns and planets in the galaxies all have zero point centers. And it's these zero point centers in cosmic bodies which gives them their rotation. See, scientists think that, they think in the, like Laplace thought that, you know, we have a disk of cosmic matter that condenses under the influence of gravity into the solar system, and it condenses more and more, and it kind of forms the clumps of the sun and the planets. And the whole thing is the gravity that organizes the solar system. In Blavatsky's view, that's completely wrong. You know, all the sun and the other planets have dynamic zero-point centers, and these zero-point centers have rotation to them. Everything in nature, it rotates, it moves. So she's saying, like in her day, and it's still a mystery today, the scientists can't explain how some planets have different retrograde motion. Because if the cosmic disk was turning in one direction, how would you get planets having retrograde motion? And why would the planets have such diverse rates of turning and so on? So there's even in science, where does the moon come? Scientists still don't know where the moon comes from, and there's different theories about it. Was it captured by the Earth as an asteroid, or was it from the destruction of another planet, or was it created out of the Earth, like a fragment that detached from the Earth? You know, we still don't know where the moon comes from. We don't know how the solar system organized. We don't know how the galaxies organized. You know, there are so, like when you go into science, like there's so many things we don't understand. Whenever you come to the most basic things, we end up in ignorance because we don't really know it. So I think there's many scientific ideas. Like I look at the secret doctrine, there's scientific ideas in that very pertinent to many of the issues we're still facing in modern science. Like what is the origin of the moon? And rereading Blavatsky's material on the secret doctrine, she has very interesting perspective on the moon. The way she explains it, she says that any cycle of life in the cosmos, there's seven phases to it. And there are seven rounds, she calls them. And each round would have seven races, and everything is sevenfold, and then seven sub-races. Okay, so Blavatsky says there's this round, seven rounds. Sorry, I've lost my train of thought a bit, Jim, what I was trying to explain here, why I came to... Oh, about the moon.
Yeah, about the moon.
Okay, so Blavatsky claims that we are on the fourth round. Like the first round of existence is in higher dimensional planes. It's not even physically manifested. Like it's more in the divine realm and the spiritual realm, and then in the psychical, and then down into the physical realm. And we're at the fourth level of this. So we're in the fourth round is most material. And on the fourth round, we are said to be the fifth root race. Okay, now, Blavatsky says there are different cycles in the solar system, and what she calls it a planetary chain, which has seven planets, and the sun is considered as one of the planets of a solar chain. But Blavatsky says the moon, it was a planet in a prior solar round. It was one of the seven vital planets. But then in this round, it became a satellite, and the Earth became one of those seven planets in that round. So the moon, in a way, is the remnant of what was a planet in an earlier round. Do you get what I'm saying, Jim, at all?
Yeah.
And she says that when one round ends, that the life principle in the planet withdraws into that planet, and it's like it goes through almost a wormhole, and then it's embodied in a new planet in the next round.
Wow.
A fascinating idea of how, like, these life principles move. So, yeah.
Yeah. Well, as you say, as I mean, the bottom line is that the more you study modern science and from a mystical and esoteric perspective, and the more deeply you examine the fundamental mysteries and enigmas that confront the materialist position on which most of the materialist, mechanistic, atheistic, reductionistic perspective which dominates modern science, the more you realize how many fundamental questions are unanswered and what the limitations are of that perspective. It's very good within a certain set of limitations for describing things, but it's not an explanation of things at all. And in terms of returning to our earlier discussion about the problem of God's contracting universe, I think that what it suggests, what the scientific enigma suggests, is a necessity of going beyond the physical to the spiritual and the metaphysical to explain these things, and that in that more comprehensive perspective, which is exactly what you're trying to do in your work, is to build a model which incorporates the metaphysical and spiritual dimensions, then things take on, things become more coherent and comprehensive, and at the same time, you realize how you can make certain basic mistakes about things by only seeing them as parts rather than seeing them in relationship to their organic connections in the whole. I mean, that's the definition of Maya or illusion from Lava Govindas, is that Maya, in the terms of something being an illusion, arises when something's torn out of its organic connections to the whole and is considered only as a part rather than as a subsidiary or as a component of something greater.
Yeah. Yeah, so things taken out of relationship to the whole creates,
yeah,
like, so in a way it's knowledge, but it's ignorance at the same time. In we don't,
yeah,
understand,
I mean,
its deeper nature.
You can go to that example of the blind man and the elephant, you know, and you know, when they all touch different parts and describe it. See, each of the blind men is really giving a perfectly accurate description of the part, but is assuming that the whole is in the part, but it's not. The whole is something quite different from the part, and that's basically what I'd say about modern science. It's like it's got fantastic descriptions, but not comprehensive explanations.
Yeah, that's the point. Blavatsky, her book, The Secret Doctrine, is an amazing critique of even modern scientific philosophy, because, you see, really, there's been no change. I've just been reading a book by Stenger,
oh, yeah,
called Quantum Gods. This,
okay,
guy wrote the book God, the Failed Hypothesis.
Oh, yeah.
And he's one of the committee of the investigation of the claims of the paranormal, eh?
Oh, yeah.
He has this book on quantum gods, which is absolutely an atrocious, terrible book. It is so superficial and frustrating and aggravating for me,
yeah,
in a way. But,
yeah,
but anyway, so I read Blavatsky and then I read that. And Blavatsky, back in 1888, this is what she called the holy creative trinity of materialist science. Okay, what three,
yeah,
elements of the holy trinity of modern science? Inert matter. Okay, so it's matter is not,
yeah,
conscious, it's just inert.
Yeah.
Senseless force. So there's not,
yeah,
intelligence or purpose,
oh, yeah,
to it. It's just,
yeah,
senseless. And blind chance. And if you read, like, Stengler's book here, just everything about evolution, it's just all random mutations and happenstance and circumstance. And then when they can't explain it, they just say it's a self-organizing feature.
Yeah.
That, you know, where they label it and they think, oh, they, you know, they don't need God now. They just say, well, it's inherently self-organizing. And that, as though that's an answer, but it still doesn't answer it. Yeah.
Yeah.
So,
well,
I mean, Blavatsky says all physics has to lead to metaphysics because these things exist. So science taken far enough, you come to your limits where you can't go further unless you adopt a metaphysical perspective.
Yeah, and I mean, I completely and utterly agree with that. Because that's the essence of it, because that's exactly what you find. And if you explore things with an open mind, as I say, I've just been reading this biology book, Biology Revision. This is just an amazing book because they go through so many different aspects of evolutionary theory and trying to explain things in terms of evolutionary theory and neo-Darwinism, and saying, you know, that there's just so many circumstances where things are so much more complicated that it's just ridiculous to say that this all happens by chance. And there's so much evidence that contradicts the idea of chance, that shows intentionality, that shows purpose, that shows intelligence way beyond what anybody would. I mean, there's a whole discussion in this book, and I think a lot of it's based on Lynn Margulis's work, again, the ex-Mrs. Sagan, on bacteria. You know, I mean, bacteria are really smart, you know, and really intelligent. And in a way, to say that all of this just happens through random mutations, which are preserved by natural selection, is completely idiotic, because it just doesn't hold. And I mean, you know,
yeah,
it's when people say, well, you know, when you invoke God or some sort of spiritual intelligence to explain things, you know, you're really grasping at straws to try to explain something that you can't explain. Well, if you really look at the materialist explanation of a variety of phenomena that scientific investigation looks at, invocation of materialist and mechanistic explanations is way beyond saying, oh, God did it. Like, it's just completely ludicrous to say that, these are material, and as you say, material processes, and we'll name them. You know, we'll say it's a self-regulating process. Well, that doesn't explain anything. It's just a label, you know. Like, I mean, you have to do better than that, fellas, to convince people, like, minds. It's silly, really.
It's funny. It's like the scientists believe in like accident theory, I call it sometimes. It's just random genetic changes. Everything is random, or like, why are the fine constants of nature so finely attuned to give rise to life just as we know it? And in a way, it's because it's just by chance, because it could have been all different parallel universes where the laws of nature weren't right and they just died out. But we happen to be one where by chance all these constants of nature were all just adjusted, that by chance it gave rise to life, which happened by chance because of stray genetic random radiations and caused random genetic changes, which by chance happened to evolve, you know. So that's considered scientific.
I consider that the completely stupidest thing I've ever heard, actually, it even might even be true, but I just see that seems to me to be the most ridiculous thing. It's like, oh, well, how am I going to explain this fine-tuning? I'm going to invoke an infinite level of randomness to explain order. to explain what I observe as order, I'm going to invoke the infinite number of other universes where everything didn't get fine-tuned. I mean, that just seems to me to be completely absurd. That's the stupidest explanation I've ever heard. It's like,
I know, but that's a popular one now.
It's so dumb. It's just easier. Why not just say God did it? One explanation, you know? Like, I mean, it's much more economical in terms of it's much more parsimonious in terms of Occam's razor. I mean, I just that. Just
well, I think either answer is not an answer.
It's not
like
an answer.
Either
exactly.
To say God did it
God
is
did
no
it.
More of an answer to say
no,
than to say it was random and accidental. Like,
yeah,
not,
exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. It doesn't explain anything. It's just a label. You know, like, both of them are completely inane. Like, you know, and that's one good thing that I like in Carl Sagan's writing when he's talking about God, and he says, you know, when he asks people, you know, you say you believe in God. What do you mean by God? Well, that's a good question. That's a very good question. What exactly do you mean when you say I believe in God? And he says, well, people say, well, you know, God. You know, and to a certain extent, I think that was the way a lot of people. It's just, you know, they've been conditioned to believe that there exists a God, and, you know, it's God's will, and God created the universe. But what is God? I mean, it's a real good question.
And what you see in all the esoteric traditions is very subtle and complex abstract ideas about the root principles of creation and about the nature of the absolute. You don't find anthropomorphized God like Carl Sagan talked about, or some people believe, like, you know, God is like this Jewish patriarch who sits in heaven, kind of.
Yeah.
So it's in the esoteric traditions, you have a more abstracted, a theoretical idea about the root principles of creation. And there are said to be spiritual intelligences and beings on different plane who have more anthropomorphic qualities as living beings.
Yeah.
But God is not this patriarch sitting in, I mean, which is senseless. So, and Blavatsky says that, like, we believe in the builders, she calls them, the seven luminous suns, which sculpt the void and create life
Yeah, much more sophisticated. And again, like, that's a problem I have with Dawkins and with Sagan and Daniel Dennett and all these, I would say, fundamentalist materialists. Sam Harris is that, you know, that they erect straw men and they attack these very limited conceptions of what it means to be religious or what it means to believe in spiritual realities and intelligences. And they sort of cherry pick these, you know, these very fundamentalist ideas about the nature of higher intelligences and beings and spirituality and God, and then they attacked them. And, you know, on a certain level, there's a certain satisfaction in that, because I agree with them, you know, that that these are ridiculous ideas. But to think that they make this quantum leap to say that, well, this explains all religious and all spiritual viewpoints is completely ridiculous, and it shows their own ignorance about these things. These guys really don't understand these things at all.
Yeah, we've lost the understanding of the ancient symbols and myths and geometry, like sacred geometry and symbols and such. Like,
yeah.
I look at something like the Tree of Life, and having studied it now for almost 30 years, and it is like such an unbelievably profound symbol, you know, unbelievable.
Yeah.
You know, the 10 spheres and how that's supposed to be a model of the structure of the universe. But but it's totally profound how it's elaborated, you know, and it all makes sense in a way.
It depends on the knowledge and the being of the person that perceives it. And again, as I say, it's easy to somebody says, well, you know, a mystical declaration that, you know, I felt myself to be at one with the universe, and people make fun of that, or to say that man is a microcosm of the macrocosm. I was like, well, that's silly. But no, it's silly if you understand it in a silly way. Then it is silly. But that's not a reflection of that saying. That's a reflection of who you are. And perfect example, like you say, is like the Tree of Life, where like Gurdjieff said at one point, I think something to the effect that when he's talking about the Enneagram, which is this ancient symbol which embodies his fourth way teaching, and he said, you know, that if a person was alone and really knew and understood everything, and they just drew an Enneagram in the sand, that they could understand all of the laws of the cosmos and themselves but if they really understood this diagram, that it's all there. And on one level, that seems like a preposterous thing to say, but once you begin to study something like the Tree of Life or the Enneagram, you realize, no, that's not a preposterous thing to say. Like, you begin to, as your own development takes you to deeper levels of interpretation and insight into things, then you realize, oh, you know, like, yeah, the Tree of Life, you know, it's not just this interesting symbol. It embodies like these cosmic principles, and
the laws of 3 and 7, and then you can find applications of those principles throughout all the areas of science. Like it's a really useful tool for understanding things in physics and other areas of science.
Yeah.
What the evidences show, like just the way the physical world, you know, it's composed of protons, electrons, and neutrons, 3 main material elements, and they form atoms in 7 rows of elements in the periodic tables. So there's like the law of 3 and 7. It's right in the chemistry tables.
Yeah.
You know, and then you can apply that to ideas about now hyperspace being 7-dimensional, which is a really important idea throughout esotericism, because we find that idea in Judaism, in the Vedas, in Kabbalah, in Gurdjieff, in Blavatsky. You know, this idea of the law of sevenfoldness is so profound. So anyway, Jim, so we should just take a minute and
Can I quickly just, before we finish, I want to read this quote. This is Jonathan Cott. Says that cosmologists have speculated that at the first explosive moment of the birth of the universe, everything that exists or ever will exist was contained within a single spark of energy smaller than an atom's nucleus and ruled by a single primordial law. And Rabbi Lawrence Kushner, who he was interviewing, says, one dot, a point of light, perhaps the fact that contemporary cosmologists talk about a dimensionless point of light from which all beings sprang, and that the capitalists long ago came up with precisely the same image. And then in brackets, in the 14th century, Moses de Leon spoke of a hidden supernal point whose primal center is the innermost light of translucence, subtlety, and purity beyond comprehension. Close bracket.
Wow.
Means that this awareness comes from something we all carry within us.
Let's end on that. That is most profound. That is why this teaching is so valuable, because we're not only talking about the creation of the universe, but also the idea that human beings have zero point centers, that consciousness and life within us is not simply a product of the body. There's a higher principle that is interconnected, the metaphysics to the physics of the physical body.
If you really understood what everything that was contained within that question and the answer, you could write 25 volumes of profound on it. Right? Like, I mean, it's an amazing question. It's an amazing answer.
Yeah. Okay, well, thanks, Jim, and we'll talk to you again in 2 weeks' time, and we'll take a brief break here for a few minutes while we get the guest on the line for the second half of the show. And if Seth has a song for us, let's hear that.
Okay, thanks, Chris. Bye.
Okay, bye, Jim.
I remember all the stories my grandpa used to tell about a time in this sacred land. The buffalo did roam out on the open plain. The eagle soared high up in the sky. They were so very proud. They lived a simple life. Mother Nature did provide. There was no law, but there was no crime. They took away our land. They put us on the run. Locked us on this reservation. Changed our ways of life. Promises were made, but they were only lies. Chiefs from long ago, they will be by your side. Into the battleground, a warrior you will ride. Armed with years of wisdom, many years of pride.
Thank you. That was Sacred Land by Robin Shaw, a native Canadian from Western Canada. Before I go on, I had forgotten to mention friend Reza out there, who I think is putting our Zero Point Radio show out through Blog Talk Radio. So thank you, Reza, if you managed to work that out today. And I'm doing every second Sunday at 6 Eastern till 8, a two-hour radio show with Reza on his Blog Talks radio site. I'll put the connection up on my website, so I will have Sunday shows for 2 hours. And thanks, Reza. Okay, so we're going to kind of switch away from the subject of kind of mystical teachings and science and talk more about what's happening in the world and the political situation in our countries. And I'd like to invite or introduce you to Ted Fish. And Ted is Canadian, lives on the western coast of Canada. He started up We Are Change group on Vancouver Island in one of the smaller communities. And he's also a member of the Canadian Action Party, which is a truth party in Canada. And I work with CAP because I do think we need to organize politically to try to take back our countries. Ted has a background in developing websites, and I've not spoken with him before, but welcome, Ted. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. Appreciate it.
Maybe you could just, would you like to share anything about your background, Ted, or your interests?
Okay, my background is education and computer science, and just recently, my background is the truth movement and chemtrails and political, political aspects of that. I studied climatology. And so, when I woke up to chemtrails, I knew something was really wrong. And so that's how I got involved in politically getting the truth out.
How many years ago did you wake up, or did you wake up with a bang, or just gradually? Some people wake up and it's like this shock to them. It was to me. I couldn't waking up.
It was April 4th of 2009. It wasn't even a year ago, and it was literally a life changing event. Literally life changing. I've never been the same since.
I have found exactly the same thing. I woke up only 3.5 years ago after seeing a movie, Loose Change, exposing 9/11, and that set off the last 3 years. I've mainly studied through the internet, and it's like you have one revelation after another. I mean, it's really quite a fascinating process, is being part of the truth movement.
It is. The knowledge that you gain once you start to explore what reality really is beyond comprehension. What the doors that have been opened to me are amazing, just amazing, endless.
Yeah, it makes sense of so many things in a way which we didn't understand or were unexplained. And I'm reminded also, though, of a quote from J. Edgar Hoover. He says, like, the normal person is handicapped by facing a conspiracy so monstrous he can't believe it could exist. And I think that is the situation of most normal people. They can't imagine that these people would have done such devious things over the decades in our countries. Like, it's unspeakable. It's terrible.
It is mind-boggling, but the only way to have it not happen again is to bring it out and explore the truth and change what's going on. And I think a big part of that has to do with the media, and I think the media plays a big role in everything that's going on in North America, at least.
Yeah, it that's part I find of waking up is I used to believe the media. I thought basically like the major TV networks and newspapers reported objectively what was happening in our countries. And then you wake up and realize in a way they've been intentionally designed to deceive us. So we don't understand what's happening.
Yeah, they're leading us down the wrong path, that's for sure. And, you know, they're owned by the people who are controlling the world, really. So,
And they have a fairly advanced kind of science of propaganda and marketing and advertising, and they're very advanced in what they do. Sorry, we just had to adjust our sound volumes there. Ted, where were we?
Well, we were talking. I guess we were talking about media and media spin and who owns the media and how diabolical the world really is, and you know, coming out and exploring the truth and how we got there.
Maybe you'd like to. Elaborate more upon the media, how I guess the issues both, what are some of their techniques and then also what we need to do in the truth movement to create alternative media.
Yeah, well, we're going to have a lot of controversial, you know, what I am is a speculator. So I go on, I use the internet and I speculate as to what the truth is. And one of the things that I find interesting is the Haiti earthquake, and not interesting from the point of the devastation and the death, and I feel very sorry for those people. But in the response to the Haiti earthquake and the media response as well. And immediately after the earthquake, which, you know, was almost prepared for the day in advance, at least they were preparing for a hurricane, from information I found on the internet. I forget where I was going with that. Oh, well, the spin is that they need all kinds of help. And the American presidents, three of them, came online on the mainstream news, and they asked for all kinds of help, and don't send blankets, send money, and where do you think that money's going to go? And there are conditions placed on American aid if America is going to get involved. And one of them was that George Bush had to lead the parade, and another one was, you know, they had control over this and that. And I can't memorize those conditions, but, you know, so we go from there. And so it goes right into asking for money, asking for help. Let's rebuild Haiti. At the same time, what are they sending there? You know, UN troops, American troops, and, you know, what's the alternative motive, if any? You know, I'm just speculating.
There definitely seems evidences for a good suspicions here. Like, it has come out that the American forces and one of their emergency response teams was all preparing for a hurricane on Haiti, and that was ongoing. That began on the day of the earthquake. And that's just right. Like on 9/11, they had exercises going on, and then the London train bombings, they were had exercises going on involving bombings in the same subways as which then occurred. There's actually a video, you've likely seen it, of a policeman saying, oh, yes, sir, well, it was strange, and then we had to kind of shift from, you know, this game playing to a real-life situation. And they have the same MO a little bit. Like that's, you know, the media was prepared ahead of time. Like I see the media, they're all scripted before these things happen. Like they were scripted before 9/11 happened. And they had the expert already who had his Osama bin Laden video, and he was all prepared to pop onto TV at the moments of greatest kind of anxiety in people and fear in people to start answering your questions and polluting your mind and shaping it. Oh, it's those Muslim terrorists. And they were reporting Osama bin Laden within half an hour of the first airplane crash against the first tower. And then almost 10 years later, there's still no evidence he had anything to do with it. But the whole thing was scripted.
And we're still chasing him, you know, and it's really funny that if you lived in the USA and you didn't pay your taxes, they'd find you. You know, they wouldn't have any trouble finding you, no matter where you were. And yet, you know, 100,000 troops can't find one guy. So
and
that's part of amazes me.
But returning to the Haiti, I mean, you see so many suspicious aspects. Like, the mainstream media would never report the suspicions that people have that this was some type of scalar weapon or even a nuclear weapon of some type that set off this earthquake and that it was done intentionally. And the manner in which the U.S. supposedly, you know, bringing in humanitarian aid really uses as a pretext to invade with massive troops and armamentation and in a way do very little for the people and even prevent teams getting in from other countries because they kind of took over the airport and
the whole thing smells, really.
Yeah.
The whole thing kind of smells and well, maybe it doesn't, but, you know, we can suspect a lot of things. On my website, alternativemedia.ca, and it's just the way it sounds, alternativemedia.ca, I found two videos on YouTube that showed, you know, weird stuff going on in Haiti prior to the earthquake. So,
could you describe those a bit? Could you describe those a bit?
One of them was a flash of light. One of them was a flash of light. Somebody posted a video, you know, of somebody riding down the street, and CBS has posted this. But there was a flash of light at the very beginning of this video that CBS, according to the video I saw on the Internet, didn't show. So almost immediately, a flash of light, and then the earthquake started. So where was this flash of light from? I don't know. But it was pretty intense, you can tell. And the second video was taken at night, and all they were doing is pointing up this camera to the sky at this intense light. And, you know, going, ooh, wow, what amazing, what is that kind of thing, right? And
was that the night before the earthquake? Or
yeah,
it was
the night before, yeah.
Wow.
And, you know, I'm not sure, I don't, I just post them. I don't put any credence into them. They could, you know, it's up to people to determine what is the truth and what is not the truth, right? Every man for himself on that one.
But yeah.
Just the fact that they surfaced and, you know, there's those possibilities anyway. And the other thing that I wanted to point out about this HARP thing is that there is an induction magnetometer, it's called, and it measures HARP activity. And there was dramatic HARP activity just prior to the earthquake. And it's displayed at the University of Tokyo, and that type of video, you know, somebody videos discussing this are on YouTube as well.
Were there readings of HARP activity during the time of the earthquake, or?
Yes, there were, or just prior, and so you know that.
HAARP has one, the major facility up in Alaska, but they also have other ones. Do they have any in the Caribbean area?
According to my research, and I haven't been there, there's one in Puerto Rico, and there's two in Alaska.
Two in Alaska. There's one in Puerto Rico.
Yeah.
Wow.
Supposedly. And
yeah.
There's two in Alaska, one in Norway, and one someplace else. And I can't remember the location right now.
Yeah.
It
was interesting that Hugo Chavez came out and accused United States or someone of using weapon to create this earthquake. But it is becoming known, like these technologies are available, like for weather modification, and this HAARP facility is a ghastly thing.
And according to, you know, even True TV, which Jesse Ventura did with the conspiracy theory, you know, they pointed out it was the death ray. And so, you know, I think it's a killer weapon, and it can be used for great destruction. So it has that power, and I urge everybody to do some research on that topic.
I mean, it's so terrible because the HAARP heats the corona up to the upper ionosphere up to a temperature equal to the sun's corona. So here they are kind of heating up the upper atmosphere. At the same time, they're saying, like, they have their global warming fraud. But we have no idea, really, of what role HAARP might be playing in heating up the atmosphere and causing other climatic changes. Like, I question the role of HAARP being used to unfreeze the Canadian Arctic, so that to open up shipping lines across from the Far East. I don't know, but
that's a question, you know, you can legitimately ask, and I'm all for finding out the answer there for sure.
It's such a shame. It's like the government is just so not responsible to the people. Like, just to use these technologies and chemtrails, and it's like the populace is completely victims of this. Like, the government...
Well, they're victims in many ways, because they're victims of ignorance, and that's where the media starts. Our CBC, you know, hasn't been too bad as of late. They did some you know, reporting on HAARP and so on, but I think they're missing the boat, and you know they missed the boat on the whole swine flu incident and on ClimateGate, and they just weren't around. And that's why we're not questioning government about HAARP, and that's why we're accepting the fact that this earthquake happened, you know, without help, and okay, let's send money.
Yeah.
And, I think we can't do that anymore. Given the weapons that are available to man, we really have to take a look at everything. And given the reality that's been given to us over the years that has been false, you know, we have to question everything.
I think even going back now and looking at earlier earthquakes, like there was unusual sky and atmospheric phenomena in China ahead of the massive earthquake they had before their Olympics.
Yeah, that's true.
And there was that, and now the threat is that, you know, United States or these elites, I mean, I don't like to call it the United States because the poor citizens of the United States are victims of their own government. I mean, they really are. Sorry, I lost my line of thought.
We have to bring this to light anyway, because I'm sure, you know, that Iran and the United States and other countries, regardless of who they are, aren't going to get along with this, with the people who own this HAARP forever, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, we don't want HAARP to be used for negative reasons. Let's just use it for positive reasons, and I'm sure there were positive reasons for developing it when it was developed, but...
It's like these people have gone mad using science. And all these things which could have been useful to humankind have been turned into weapons almost. Like, I don't think we know what kind of radiations people might be subjected through the new TV technologies. And then we have these, all these cell towers and these Gwen towers, the low electromagnetic frequencies that hug the ground that might affect mood and other psychotropic effects. I mean, we just don't know, in a way.
Yeah, no, we don't. And that part is really scary. And when you look up in the sky and you see a ripple of clouds, and, you know, I'm just south of Hearth, really, so I see a lot of activity. And you can see what Hearth does to the clouds, and it kind of lines them up like a magnet would in a science experiment.
Yeah.
So they all line up nice. So, you know, Hearth's at work in the sky. And that, you know, I listen to the ringing in my ear and listen to see if I can actually hear Hearth, because there is a noise to it. So
wow. Yeah, you're relatively close up on the Vancouver Island there. You're not. How far are you from Hearth? Like 1,000 kilometers, 2,000?
Well, maybe 1,000, 1,500 kilometers. So
yeah,
and it's supposed to be two installations up there. So, you know, we're probably feeling the effects there, no doubt.
Yeah, and let's talk a little bit about chemtrails. Well, I don't know if you wanted to get back to the media, but I did want to ask you about chemtrails. We had one clear day here in Ottawa yesterday, and we got the massive doses. I saw at least 15 aircraft this afternoon laying chemtrails all over Ottawa today. How was your chemtrail day in BC?
Well, you know, it's hard to say because they're pretty good at it, and I don't. On Vancouver Island, you know, I haven't really seen a clear day in months.
Wow.
You know, they lace the clouds, they lace the blue sky, they just cover it up. So, or they cover it up someplace else, or they use the chemtrail someplace else, and that blows in over top of the island. So we're a consequence. I don't know if we're a target, but we're a consequence.
From your studies, what do you think are the main ingredients of the chemtrails and how those might affect us?
Well, there's a list of health problems and you know, here they go. Here's a list of health problems. Persistent hacking coughs, and these aren't deep coughs, these are just, you know, short cough, really. Upper respiratory and intestinal distress, pneumonia, lethargy, dizziness, heart attacks, and high blood pressure. I can prove that with myself. Thickening of blood, splitting headaches, nosebleeds, allergic reaction, and if you really don't want, you know, if it's really bad where you are, Morgellons disease, and perhaps even sudden death. Those are some of the symptoms.
Wow.
They aren't so great. And, you know, to combat these, you know, I combat them with two things, especially colloidal silver and zeolite. And, you know, I take a lot of vitamins, vitamin D and vitamin C.
Yeah. Yeah, I use oregano oil in addition to some of those things. Yes, indeed. Yeah, I wonder, like, one of the major ingredients of chemtrails is aluminum and barium salts. And aluminum, that's one of the hypothesized causes of Alzheimer's, is the accumulation of aluminum in the brain. And in the States now, one out of two families has a grandparent with Alzheimer's. Like, it's becoming so widespread, but people are being sprayed massively. It's like the use of fluoride to dummy people down. Well, this is like you could almost cause like massive kind of mental degeneration in people through this.
Well, there's no doubt there's an impact in people's mood, in people's health. You know, I've researched health just a little bit and found that, you know, respiratory diseases are on a huge rise. And, you know, it's from this. It's from the spraying, and, you know, why are they spraying? you know, other than weaponry and maybe radar, or are they hiding something from us, or are they trying to kill us? There's all kinds of speculation, you know, so I would urge the government to come out and tell us what exactly is going on.
Yeah, I must say, I regard the people who chemtrail spray, I regard them as terrorists because they are terrorizing us, because this is biological and chemical warfare that's being perpetrated against us, the citizens of these countries. So I regard them as terrorists, and whoever is behind it needs to be arrested as terrorists, because this is, you know, administration of toxic substances. You know, these are criminal acts. They're criminal acts against the environment. It's killing off, like, bees and amphibians and other kinds of wildlife, and altering the balance of the soil and of the water. I mean, really, our whole country has been sprayed with these toxins. It's quite disgraceful.
It is disgraceful, and it's very disturbing because, you know, I used to enjoy the outside, and I really don't anymore, and I stay indoors for the most part, and so that, for that reason, it's changed my life, and, you know, I'm kind of not very happy about that, really, but I think people ought to make adjustments, especially if they're in a high toxic area, and, you know, whether they're after you or just using chemtrails for some other purpose. You know, I would venture indoors.
Yeah. I'm convinced that there is a group of psychopathic elites who are, I mean, they even stated openly they believe in reducing the world's population, and population growth they see as the greatest hazard to the earth. And I think they would like to reduce the world's population to their estimated 500 million, which, you know, the Masonic goofball put up on the Georgia Guidestones.
Yeah, well, I've seen that too. And you know, I believe that you're right. This is kind of a scientific culling of the people. And a lot of this is just testing different populations, I believe, like they've tested in the past, right back to the, you know, who knows, 50, 40, you know, spraying different populations. So I think a lot of this is just test and determination, you know, what's going to happen if we do this, and what's going to happen if we do that. Some of it's weaponry. You know, I know HARP probably uses chemtrails, and I can't say that for sure, but almost 100% uses chemtrails and in their beam, in their death ray, or with their death ray in combination. It just seems likely because we get inundated, you know, here along the coast where there's two HARP installations. So it kind of seems, unless they're using it for radar along the coast and looking for submarines, you know, Chinese submarines or Russian submarines or something like that. So those are.
Yeah, well, I live in Ottawa, and there are not too many submarines in Ottawa. I mean, these things are being done all over the mainland of America. I mean,
multiple uses. There's multiple.
Yeah.
There's multiple uses for chemtrails. They're not just you know, for one thing.
Yeah, it can be. I would think that the chemtrails, like, it can work with HARP because it gives HARP a reflective mirror to that, you know, because it can bounce beams off the ionosphere, and it could reflect their beams off. You know, if you have a breadth of aluminum particles in the atmosphere, I mean, it's kind of ionizing the atmosphere and giving you a reflective mirror.
Right. Yeah. Well, you know, I think they can do a lot of holographic stuff too.
Could be a basis for holographic stuff. Yeah. Wow. That's interesting.
Yeah. Well, you know, I can't really go there on the radio, but if you go back to the earthquake discussion and the China discussion and the images, you know, even though they were just color above the earthquake location prior to the earthquake in China, then, you know, you may have some indication of that.
Yeah. Yeah, wow, it's a kind of nightmare scenario. I did want to ask you, one of the most, for me, interesting issues is concerning 9/11 and the role of the media on that day. And have you ever watched the video series called September Clues?
No, I haven't, no.
That is an absolutely fascinating series, 10 parts, each about 6 minutes long, all based on the original media coverage of the day of 9/11. And when you see it presented, you see right through it. You realize how the witnesses were faked. And there were so many fraudulent aspects to it that stand out immediately when you see the original footage. And this is available on YouTube. I would encourage you. And the most important issue raised by this series is the idea that the pictures of the airplane striking the second tower was really produced in the media studios, and that there really was, in fact, no airplane hitting the second tower. These were simply concocted in the media studios. Do you have any kind of personal investigations?
I have theories, and you know, I've seen YouTube videos where the little UFOs over top of the Twin Towers, and I've seen many of them, and many of these little type of vehicles, you know, that kind of look like saucers, all over the place, really, on YouTube videos. So, you know, this is a common thing, and I saw those over top of the 9/11 building. So it appeared to me that they might have something to do with it. And to me, the 9/11 buildings were almost vaporized.
Were almost
when
what?
I watched it, vaporized.
Yeah.
You know, like,
yeah.
Oof, gone. And
pulverized, like,
so
that the massive amount of concrete into particulate clouds. I mean, unbelievable. And even the pile afterwards, like, was only like about 4 or 5 stories when it should have been like 30 or something.
Exactly. So that, you know, that to me, how could have somebody done that?
Yeah.
And so then maybe it was the HAARP again, right?
Yeah. Or some other kind of directed energy weapon. I mean, they've developed this weaponry and really kept it secret from the public. I mean, if the public really knew what our governments were doing, they would be running down the street.
Well, definitely. And if we knew what they were doing, we'd be running down the street too, you know, because it's pretty tough to come across the truth without a whole lot of speculation in it. But, you know, because it's never provided for us. It's ridiculous. So, you know, media doesn't do any investigation at all, and they always give you this half-truth stuff, and, you know, or decoys of the whole thing. Well, in the Haiti case, raising money, then rather than researching, okay, what really happened, you know?
Yeah. And are you familiar, was there a question about how much of the money from the tsunami raised for the tsunami victims actually got to the tsunami people, the people of those parts of the world? And wasn't there kind of massive fraud over that money?
Well, I'm not sure. I didn't do any research into that. But wherever you have a lot of money, you're bound to have some fraud.
Yeah.
And, you know, there was a huge fundraising for that. And so guaranteed, somebody was making money there too. But, you know, you have to investigate each situation on its own, and because it's bound to be different crooks.
But it's like, also, once you wake up, you see that, like, so many of these incidents are obvious frauds. Like this guy, underwear bomber. Okay. I mean, I'm a clinical psychologist. I would not believe that any male would put combustible material in his underpants hoping to blow up an airplane. Like, it's the sickest possible joke. And then there's eyewitnesses that the authorities in this country allowed this fellow on without a passport, and there was someone on the airplane filming him. I mean, the whole thing was obviously a false flag event, and then the guy turned up to be a Al-Qaeda from Yemen, where the Americans want to attack and murder more people over there next, because they're murdering them in Pakistan, and they murder them around the world. So the whole thing was a fraud, and then they come out and they're bringing in these very personally invasive screening devices to the airport, which is just terrible. Hundreds of thousands of dollars. Sorry?
The stocks went through the roof, right? The people who made those scanners had already made the scanners. You know, they were ready to be put into all these airports. So whoever owned all these scanners, you know, made a lot of money.
Yeah, and they were even ordered before, ahead of time.
They were all ready for the scam, for sure. And
yeah.
That's our media, you know, and they played out that little terrorist event for a couple of weeks, but they never reported the suspicions. You know, we have witnesses, and if you look back at my postings on that in alternative media, you know, I posted a lot of links, and there were witnesses, and I posted the links to the witnesses so that, you know, but the FBI never either interviewed them or disregarded what they said. So it was, you know, it's kind of the outcome is already planned. Here's the outcome we want. What do we have to do to achieve that?
Yeah.
And then they go about their business.
Yeah.
So, you know,
it's quite disgraceful. To think the media would have this big propaganda campaign about the swine flu and encouraging people to take these shots really completely untested and with very serious possible medical side effects. And the media sells it to people. 40% of Canadians got the shots. It's terrible.
You know, that's very unfortunate. And that was kind of a media-led, government-led hype thing. And and that was led by the pharmaceutical companies. They can spend hundreds of millions of dollars to make hundreds of billions of dollars.
Yeah.
So money's no object to get this propaganda out so that they can make some money, because they'll recover it tenfold.
Yeah. Well, you know, Ted, I have this idea that what I try to promote is the concept in the world that we have to apply the anti-terrorist legislation, which allows you to seize the asset of anyone involved in terrorist activities. And if we could really, if the police ever decided to be police again instead of protecting the criminals, if the police ever wanted to stand up to their jobs again and enforce the laws of Canada, we'd have a lot of major elites sitting in prisons, and we'd have a lot of assets seized, and all the media would be seized, because these people own all the media who have been complicit. They're accessories after the fact, the mass murder. They're involved, they're implicated in trying to carry forward genocidal measures against people, public deception. I mean, all the media need to be seized as assets of a terrorist organization and returned to the countries and to the people who work in those media, so the media could once again be responsible and truthful media personnel.
Yes, depending on what level you work for the media, those who work for mainstream media are trapped by, you know, the same trap we are. They're controlled. And
yes.
What they say is controlled. And so whether they're good people or they want to report the truth or not, you know, it's not likely to come out.
Yeah, exactly. And that's why, in ways, like, see, you could just seize the assets of all the media, and everybody who works for them could still keep on working, but all of a sudden they'd really be allowed to tell the truth. They would be thrilled. They really would. It would be like they'd have their jobs back again. I mean, I went to the SPP protest in Ottawa 2 years ago about when Montebello was on. And I went to a press conference there in a hotel where there were different speakers against the SPP. And I had to pop out to get my film. I was filming some of the press conference. And as I came back, one of the major networks had a TV crew that was leaving the meeting. And I knew it wasn't over. And I said to the people as they got in the elevator and I got out, I said, "You people must be ashamed of yourself for what you do." And the woman there said, "We are." And I thought that very significant, because they are ashamed of themselves. You know, I don't think people go into journalism wanting to deceive their countrymen and their neighbors, and then they get in there and it's so corrupted that they, in a way, they need to be liberated.
They do, but, you know, we need to be liberated, too. I think, you know, people, knowledge is liberating, and I think as people find out this, you know, the stuff that's going on little by little and in different ways, from climate gate, the swine flu hoax, and all these different, you know, things.
All these hoaxes, eh? The moon landing hoax? Do you believe that the moon landing was a hoax? From your study?
Well, you know what? I don't know. I never studied the moon landing, but, you know, other than see a few videos and maybe read a few chapters about it. I don't, you know, to me, anything's up for grabs now. You know, they've lied to me about all these things. They may have lied to me about everything else. So
exactly.
Investigate. We really have to verify our history. You know, because who says it happened the way they said it happened?
Yeah. Yeah, they've rewritten history. It's like when you go into our universities, you don't really learn the true history of World War II or Vietnam or any of the wars. It's these people give us their version, sanitized to conceal their own role.
Yes. Or, you know, or to conceal knowledge that they don't want you to know.
Yeah.
And, you know, or they change it, or, you know, because there's a lot of things that are unexplained in the world, and, you know, that's what I start looking at, too. Okay, what is everything that's unexplained in the world, and why is it unexplained? Look at how smart we are. And is it just unexplained because nobody wants to explain it, or, you know, what's the deal here? And so is there a secret knowledge, you know, that we know nothing about? And they're not telling us. It's not in the textbooks. You know, this is an interesting avenue for exploration as well.
Yeah,
I
mean, I really believe there are. I mean, you just see instances of it, like that American inventor who invented a car which could go from coast to coast of the United States on 22 gallons of water.
Oh.
I forget the fellow's name. I've seen pictures of it. And then he took it to the military, and the military took his inventions, and it disappeared, and he died mysteriously of food poisoning. I mean, and the history is littered, like cases like Reich and his Orgone Energies, and all these kind of innovative inventors who have been persecuted for zero-point technologies and alternate cancer cures. And you know, we have this, like, pharmaceutical mafia, really, that has this kind of control of our medical profession.
Well, they're taking control of the, you know, our food, too. I mean, they're trying with Monsanto, and, you know, I guess Monsanto leads the way. Basically, you know, it's almost an assault on our entire way of life and through various prongs. And you know, it's very, very alarming that, you know, even the destruction of family, perhaps, through the media. And you know, through videos and through video games and you know, what are these video games and what are these videos teaching people, and what are these movies showing people, right? And they're giving them the problem, they're also giving them the solution. There's all kinds of things that go into movies, and if you think media is controlled, then likely Hollywood's controlled too, and has been for quite some time.
Yeah.
So whatever you see is the reality they want you to see.
Mm-hmm.
It may not be the truth. I think there's all kinds of videos on the web about turning the TV off so that you can open up your mind.
I have a TV in my house, but I have no cable. I haven't watched TV for the last year. But the internet is something completely different. It is like this amazing tool. You can kind of tap into the Akashic record almost. All this information, any subject you might conceive, is quite fascinating.
A real generalist, and you know, that's what I'd become, you know, because after I saw the, you know, chemtrails and found out what chemtrails were all about, and that leads you to HARP, and that leads you to, okay, you know, all the UN nations are getting sprayed, why is that, you know, and then that leads you down another road, and it's just amazing. The internet is just such an amazing tool, and especially YouTube, you know, because you can watch it almost like TV. So if that's the way you're used to it, you know, and that's the way our population is used to seeing the information,
yeah,
you know, rather than reading it or whatever. They're used to it coming at them. And, what you know, the hypnosis of the TV hits them and, you know, shuts their brain down. So
yeah,
I think our society's trained to be, you know, society of repeaters. And, you know, they learn that in school to some extent, and then they go off to, they look at a movie and they fall in love with the idol, and then they want to repeat that for themselves. And rather than, you know, exploring their own individuality, they're repeating.
It's also like there's this whole media of titillation and it's like it always leads to kind of moral degeneracy almost, the media influence, I think. I agree. I think they've used it to try to break up families. They don't want families, to promote varied sexual arrangements and couples and so on. They've used the media to undermine the kind of spiritual and moral fabric of our societies, and wanton violence and complete deception. So,
complete deception, really. But if you look at the various TV shows and movie shows, you know, people give you idols and people to worship, and you know, those idols might be Madonna or Britney or Michael Jackson or whatever. But they present these people, and they present their message through these people. Either subliminally or, you know, through the music itself. So, you know, paying attention to what, you know, the lyrics and the music and the videos is, when you start paying attention, you start to realize, oh, there's a bigger message here.
Well, it certainly is a fascinating process, learning about all these things and waking up. I mean, even though at times it's really threatening, I would never want to go back to simply being in ignorance. You know, it reminds me, sometimes I compare our world situation to the Lord of the Rings story, and there's kind of these forces of light are gathering around the world to fight this oppressive, kind of tyrannical forces that have taken over the world. And the people who stay home and watch their TVs, they're like hobbits who stay home. You know, that's how I think of them. I think, oh yeah, all you hobbits, you know, you watch your TV, you know. And at least in the truth movement, you know, I see the people, we have some moral integrity, and we feel outraged by what's being done to us and our neighbors and our countries and people around the world. Like it's really, the more you wake up to it, the horror of it is terrible. But at least we're awake to it, and I think that's really important, and we need to try to do what we can to oppose this madness.
Well, it is madness, and, you know, it's funny, but the madness is controlled by very few people, but they create such madness across the world, and it's amazing that so few people can control so many, but it's true.
Yeah.
and you know, government and media. You know, government, I don't know if media is in government's back pocket or government is in media's back pocket.
You know, I see them both as in the back pockets of the people, like for shadow government groups. I mean, they own the media, like you said. Most all the North American media is owned by about five companies with intertwining boards of governors and executives, and then the government. Similarly, I mean, they're just puppets for the real controlling influences behind the government, because the government never serves Canadian citizens. It always serves the interests of the corporate elites in everything.
It does, and the government's just put there, really, by the corporate elite. And, you know, I look at it, like I heard this someplace a couple of days ago, where you can picture a tortoise on top of a fence post.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that would be Harper, because he didn't get there on his own. You know, somebody put him there.
Yeah.
And he's not going anywhere either, unless somebody takes him down.
Yeah.
So, you know, he's stuck between a rock and a hard place, really.
And these people leave, though, and they've accumulated such wealth and connections for their deviousness, and it's so discouraging. Anyway, yeah. I noticed, Ted, we're coming towards the end of the show. We've just got a few minutes left. That I encourage listeners to go to this alternativemedia.ca and watch those original videos concerning Haiti and evidences for these unusual phenomena surrounding the earthquake. And did you have any other website, Ted, that you wanted to direct people to?
Well, I direct people to wearechangecowichan.ca. We do a few things there, but primarily, you know, I do a lot of research on the web, and I post it on alternativemedia.ca, and I think that's where you're going to get your best bang for the buck and stay up to date.
Yeah, excellent, Ted, and thank you for your service, you know, that making these efforts. It's like none of us want this cross to bear, really, to fight the New World Order. Like,
insane. It is. You know? I have no desire, you know, I'm ready for, you know, just rest and R&R. That's all I want, you know. I don't need a fight, but I think, you know, this is an information war, so we can all get involved.
Yeah.
And the sooner we all know everything, you know, or most things, the better off we're going to be as a society, because then we can control it.
Yeah, thank you very much, Ted, and thank you for your service to your countrymen and to the truth movement. And I hope we'll have you back at another time.
Good. Look forward to it. Thank you
very
much.
Thanks, Ted. Goodbye. Okay, so I noticed we're just coming to the end of the show here. Once again, I'd like to thank BBS Radio, and Seth, thanks for helping out today. And we'll be back in 2 weeks' time. My website is at zeropoint.ca, and I hope you enjoyed the show today, the first half on mystical occult studies, and the second more on what's happening in our current world situation. And let's keep growing in the truth movement. It's once you wake up, you can't go back, and so we can only grow as a movement, and I think that's happening. I believe these things can turn on these people, and that we may find that the police and military at some point begin to turn and say enough is enough, that they'll honor their oaths and the morals of their units. Okay, so thank you, BBS Keep Heart. We'll be back in 2 weeks. Thank you. Goodbye.